Hello, everybody. You're listening. You've tuned in, with any luck, to the... Well, if you're listening, obviously you tuned in to the Shit Show with J-Bo. And my voice is a little out today. Got a bit of a cold, as fate would have it. But I'm going to trudge onward here. I'm very, very excited today. Pete Best basically started what we know today as the Beatles. There were a couple minor incarnations, I don't know if that's the right word, but before he joined, but basically once he joined, they went to Hamburg and became an amazingly potent band. And, you know, he was with them for 2 years. He actually played live with the Beatles more time spent on stage than Ringo Starr ever did. You know, Beatles toured from, 63 to 65. Pete Best was in with them for 2 years, 60 to 62, in Hamburg mostly, and in the Cavern. And they were playing Mammoth sets. So he actually, you know, the drummer that played the most with them on stage. I thought that was a cool little tidbit, even more than Ringo. Anyway, we're going to get to the heart of the matter here. I'm going to give him a call here. I'm a little nervous. I kind of stayed up all night, and I didn't stay up all night. I got up at 4 because I couldn't sleep, and tossing and turning with Beatles songs in my head, like it was pretty insane. So this is real special for me, and bear with me. Any weird technical stuff, we'll hopefully get past it. But anyway, I'm gonna call him right now. Let's see if he answers, or maybe his brother Rogue will answer. Here we go.
Hello, Casbah.
The Casbah? Did I reach the Casbah?
Yeah, that's you, Jesse, yeah?
Yes, this is me. Who is this?
Okay,
is this...
I'm gonna put Pete on for you right now.
This is Rogue. Okay, hey, Rogue. All right, thanks,
okay.
Man.
Hang on. Hey, Jesse.
Hello, Pete.
Yeah, how are you?
I'm really good, and I'm. It's a little bit surreal talking to you actually today.
Why is that?
Because the Beatles, in my personal like, they're legendary. I mean, it's just their legend is looms so large, man. And
okay,
I flip out when I talk to people who've actually seen the Beatles, and to talk to you who actually was in the Beatles, a founding member, as I see it, it's pretty amazing. Thank you so much for doing this interview today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to someone who's interested in what I'm doing at the present moment.
Absolutely. Well, I have been listening to the Heyman's Green. That's been a couple years, though, now, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the first album we put out, which was totally original material. And as you most probably surmised by listening to the tracks, most of it was to do with my life story, you know, in some shape or form. So, yeah, it was great. We were proud of it. We were proud of the fact that it was written by the band and myself. And we were happy with the results, actually, Jess, which was the big thing.
I will say there's some really nice psychedelia in there. Some backwards guitars, and it's very lush. It's a very, very good recording. And I think the songs are great, man. We're actually going to play... We're going to play three of those songs a little bit later today. So.
Oh, that'd be great. That'd be great.
Heck, yeah. So, do you mind if we take a little trip down memory lane, Pete?
No, by all means, you know, as long as it did, you know, while we're doing that, we can mention the fact about the new website and Facebook and Twitter and all the other bits and pieces.
Well,
no problems, yeah.
Well, basically, we're going to work from there up to modern day, and we'll talk about all that towards the end, okay?
Oh, that's great. Okay.
Okay, so I watched this great called The Beatles at Their Best. It was a YouTube thing. Somebody put it together, and... I was very interested. Well, first of all, your brother, he picked up, and he said the Casbah. Now, are you actually at the Casbah now, the original Casbah?
Yep. I'm in the office, which is actually above the Casbah, the original Casbah, which was my mother's creation. And, of course, the Casbah opened in August 1959, which was an incredible long time ago. But we're still getting the tourists, you know, flocking through. So there's tours going through here every day, Jesse, which is great for the club and great for the heritage that our mother left us.
Now, I heard this interesting tidbit that your mother won enough money to buy that house betting on a horse called Never Say Die. Is that true?
That's correct, yes. You know, when we've told that story, people look at us or listen to us and turn around and say, no, that's a fairy story. That's a publicity stunt. We don't believe that anything like that happened. And believe you me, it did. I was there when I was, you know, the derby was getting won by Never Say Die with Lester Piggott on this, you know, outside of a horse and, a young jockey, which no one knew about in England, and this prestigious race, you know, the 54 Derby. And I knew my mother was interested in horse racing, but I didn't realize what was afoot and what she'd done. And it was only when, you know, she got a little bit excited as, you know, Never Say Die started to come and, you know, got through, you know, and actually won the Derby, that she let out this incredible shriek and turned around and said, you know, I've won my dream house, which, of course, was Eamon's Green, where we are now at this present moment in time. And then we all sort of turned around and said, where did you get the money from to actually bet that amount of money? And she turned around and said, I pawned all my jewelry. And that was it. That left us, as we turned around and say, in Liverpool, gobsmacked. You know, what we thought of, all we could think of then was that she's won. You know, she's won the money to, you know, buy this fantastic house, which, you know, has got so much history in it and around it now. But at that time, we were also thinking about the fact, what if it lost? You know, we'd have been penniless. But,
how much money did she put on that horse?
Oh, goodness. It came in at 33-1. And I think the only way I could explain it, Jesse, was the fact that it gave us, or gave her, enough money to basically buy the house. So she must have been talking about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pounds, you know, that she actually bets on that.
And that's hundreds of pounds. I'm sorry, like, that's a heck of a lot of money these days, right?
When you talk way back to 1955, early 1950s, you're talking about £100 being the equivalent of about £1,000 by today's standards. Wow. You know, at least. So that was the speculation, but she was convinced she was going to do it. And by God, are we so proud of the fact that she did, you know.
Basically, directly, I mean, I will go so far as to say, had she not bet on that horse, you would have not met John Lennon and Paul McCartney at your fledgling club, the Casbah, and never joined the Beatles, correct?
That's correct. There's so many things which, you know, that horse and my mother were responsible for. You know, because of that, we got the house at Heyman's Green. She had this, you know, great idea to bring music to the kids of Liverpool. She opened the Casbah Coffee Club, which became basically overnight, you know, the rock and roll club in Liverpool. And that was her dream. You know, it started off with, even though we were open 7 nights a week, she decided she wanted to put live music on at the weekend. And that's what she did. And then she gradually grew with it. You know, live music took over and became 7 nights a week. Nearly every major band in Liverpool played here. You name it, Jerry and the Pacemakers, the Searchers, King Size Taylor. You know, I could go on and on. The Beatles, to say no more. You know, they played here. But the beauty of it was, Jesse, that she also gave a lifeline to the younger bands in Liverpool. Her motto was, try out at the Casbah. If the crowd likes you, then you get another booking. If not, the door's not shut. Go away, rehearse, and come back again. And the minute the crowd accepts you, then you've got your foot in the door, and we'll give you more bookings. And it worked a treat, because so many bands started off here that were basically unknown and rose to great heights in Liverpool, which was fantastic.
Did Rory Storm and the Hurricanes play there?
They played here. They were one of the first bands. The Quarrymen was the first band. That was the lineup of John George Paul and Ken Brown. They didn't have a drummer in those days. And then the next band to play was Derry and the Seniors. And, of course, the third band to play was Rory Storm and the Hurricanes.
Oh, that you mean, is that all in one night, or you mean, like, a different days?
On different days. Okay. I mean, at that time, it was one band per night. And then she came up with the idea. She did outside promotions as well, and then she put two or three bands on. And then as the club progressed, she put, you know, double bands on at the weekend. You know, she was a businesswoman as well as being a mother, you know, and she was also you know, had a good business head on her shoulder, and that's why they nicknamed her, the mother of Merseybeat in Liverpool.
Oh, no doubt. I didn't realize that was her nickname. That's amazing, man.
The media gave her that nickname, you know, and I think it was a title which so aptly deserved. You know, they got it so right that time.
Now, you The first time, I'm kind of interested, your first impression of John Lennon, Paul McCartney. I know they were part of, they helped set up the Casbah, like they painted the ceilings. And I know now even you can go to, I guess, Liverpool and see the ceilings that you guys painted, and the Casbah is as it is back in the day, right? What were your impressions?
It's the only, I suppose you could say, honestly, it's the only club in Liverpool now which stands basically as it was when it closed its doors in 1962. And you've still got this, you know, the Aztec ceiling, which John Lennon painted, the rainbow ceiling, which Paul McCartney painted, the salmon ceiling, which George Harrison painted, the spider's web, which I painted, the John Lennon painting over the fireplace, which since Cynthia Lennon was commissioned to, the stars in the actual coffee bar itself, which was painted by all of us. You know, everywhere you look, there's a piece of, you know, the Beatles have involved themselves in the club, and I think that's what the people expect and what they realize when they come. They actually feel that atmosphere. The presence is there all the time. And, of course, the first reaction, my first reaction when I saw John, I loved the way he looked, you know, with his sideburns and baseball boots and, you know, KDs. That, to me, was like a young rock and roller. And as history portrays now, over a period of time, when I joined him, you know, John and I became very, very, very good friends. And, you know, that friendship lasted right up until the point of his stupid death in with that idiot Chapman.
Oh, really? So you got, oh, wow, that's amazing. Yeah, a horrible day in 1980 there. And Paul McCartney, now, were they like this inseparable duo when you first saw them? I mean, you know, they're one of the greatest songwriting partnerships, maybe, well, I think the greatest songwriting partnership of all time. But seeing them interact, was it pretty obvious? They were like the yin and yang of each other. What was that like to see them both, like, hang out and whatnot?
It was great because, I mean, I was fortunate in a way because when they actually played here the first night in August 1959, I was actually in the audience. I was there to make sure that, as the, you know, the family member and one of the people who, you know, ran the club, everything was okay for them. And I saw the reaction, you know, the interplay between the two of them, the reaction that they had, you know, the interplay that they had with the audience. And then, of course, when I joined them and I got to know them more on a personal level, and I used to sit behind them for 6-7 hours a night in Germany and watch, you know, watch them playing off one another. And you could tell there was this great unity, this great camaraderie was there, which they used, as we would call it, there was a little bit of one-upmanship. You know, yeah, John would say something, Paul would come on and try and top it, but it worked great for the band. There was always a banter going on, there was always a great atmosphere, there was always a laugh and a joke on stage, which got over to the audiences, whether they could understand what we were saying, but whatever was happening, that magic was there, the relationship with the audience was there, and of course that grew when they became the icons of the music industry.
I think the brilliant stroke of John Lennon inviting Paul McCartney into his band was showed a lot of strength, because McCartney, I believe, was actually the stronger musician, maybe even the better singer and songwriter, but he strengthened the group as opposed to kept himself the leader, which I thought was very interesting.
Well, I think, you know, he realized Mac's potential most probably from an early age. That benefited the band, you know, even when they were the Quarrymen at EG as a skiffle group, you know, and of course, even when they started off again as the Quarrymen and also with Paul. I mean, that's one thing which you can't take away from Paul. You know, he's a brilliant PR man, he still is even today. But in those days, I mean, the range which he had, you know, when he was younger, his vision, you know, what he did with songs which were just standard songs, how he transformed them into, you know, great rock and roll numbers. You know, Besame Mucho, you know, Your Feet's Too Big. He took all numbers and he, you know, he put a little bit of magic into it and they went down so well with the crowds. And I think that was the indication from a very, very, very early age, you know, the genius of the man.
Yeah, you know what's funny? You mentioned Besame Mucho. Right before I called you, I played Besame Mucho from the Decca demos and Money from the Decca demos. And I'll tell you what, I love that version of Money. I had never heard it before about a week ago. And
it's pretty savage. It's yeah. Fierce, and it's, you know, that's what we were about in those days. You know, we were savage young rockers. You know, we were a rock and roll band. This is before, you know, Epstein got hold of us and put us into suits, and, you know, the Beatles emerged as the world knows the Beatles today. But before that, we were savage, ferocious rockers. You know, they couldn't take that away from us.
Well, speaking of that, a couple points I wanted to touch on. There was a sect of kind of like punk, I would call them punk rockers or gangsters by today's standards, but they're called the Teddy Boys. Now, were the Beatles Teddy Boys, or were they kind of slightly more clean cut, and the Teddy Boys were the real, like, low-end, rough guys?
No, there was still an element of Teddy Boy in us. I mean, the Teddy Boy was just a little bit before our era. Okay, even though, you know, the Teds were still around when we were, you know, playing in Liverpool. But what you've got to think of, Jess, is the fact that, you know, in Liverpool, you know, we're an industrial town, or we're, was an industrial town, you know, we're a dockside town. So, you know, there's a lot of people in there which come up, you know, they're working class, and they've, you know, they've got to handle themselves in business and on the streets. And because of that, you know, the image was there, and you adapted to it. We went a little bit more towards the rocker side. You know, we moved away from the, you know, the Teddy Boy drapes and the, you know, the Beetle pickers or Beetle boots, which weren't the Beetle boots that you'd be talking about.
Right.
These were what we used to call Beetle crutches, with thick suede shoes, which had like 2-inch crepe soles on the bottom of them.
Oh, really?
But, yeah, and that was part of the Teddy Boy image, the, you know, the long draped jackets, you know, the Edwardian style, the string ties, you know, the drainpipe trousers. When we were coming along, and, you know, even though we'd worn that for a little while, we were starting to change a little bit. We were more into the you know, the jeans and the, you know, the baseball boots and the, you know, the long sideboards and the, you know, the bomber jackets and all that kind of stuff, you know, so we were a little bit more rockier.
Okay. Now, there was a story, I've been reading this book called Shout by Philip Norman, and I wanted to concentrate on the era that you were with the Beatles and slightly before that, just to get a feel for the whole thing. It said at one point, and this concerns a Teddy Boy thing, where you and John Lennon actually got into a fight with some guys who were beating up Stu Sutcliffe. Is that right? And were you in the band at that point?
Yes, that's right. It happened at a place, I mean, this has been misquoted many times, Jesse. The actual place where it took, this actually happened was in Liverpool. It was at a place called Latham Hall, which is down on the dockfront. And, yes, it was right. Stu was the smallest in the band. He was with us that particular night. And, the Teddy Boy element, or the hard case element, as we call them, picked on Stu. And they started to beat him up. Now, John and I were backstage, and a couple of the girls ran backstage shouting and screaming and turned around and said that Stu was getting beaten up. And, of course, John and I ran out. We jumped into the melee. You know, we started butting people and, you know, making sure Stu was okay. John ended up with a broken finger, which he wasn't too happy about because he had to go on and play with a broken finger. But as I was talking about that before, we'd established ourselves as, you know, being able to handle ourselves. Our reputation was there. Yet they are musicians, you know, and I suppose what a lot of people think is that because you're a musician, you're a bit of a softy, you know. But once we'd established that, it was like, no, the Liverpool lads, you know, but they can handle themselves.
Oh, so
and that was like a compliment, yeah.
After that brawl, think you're, you kind of changed for you, your reputation then, yeah?
Well, the reputation was there, but it was very much a case of, you know, they'd seen it firsthand, and it wasn't a case of, hang on, these guys aren't softies, they aren't Nandy Pandies, you know, treat them with the respect, because, you know, they can punch it out, and they can handle themselves with the best of the guys in Liverpool. Okay. And that was great, because, you know, there was a lot of trouble going on in the, you know, the different dance halls in Liverpool at that time, and of course, even in Germany, you know, so it was good being able to handle yourself in Germany, where trouble was pretty prevalent as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, speaking of being a savage rock band, I'm really interested. I've heard the term the atom beat thrown around, A-T-O-M, the atom beat. And from what I've gathered, it was a way that you guys, when you were in Germany, what they called Max Schau, which is make a show, basically, and it was you throbbing that bass drum and really getting the crowd worked out.
Yeah,
how did
that's
that
right.
Work out?
I because of... the equipment we had in those days, and, you know, because of the excitement that was created on stage, I wanted to bring out a type of drumming which would reinforce the fact that we wanted to play, you know, good, heavy type rock and roll music. And I wanted to personify the beat behind and link in with Stu and, you know, project the band forward. And, of course, I came up with the idea of playing a four-bar bass drum beat, which really emphasized what was going on. Because you've got to remember, Jesse, in those days, we weren't amped up to anything. We went through mixer desks or, you know, sound systems. What we put out on stage, what we blasted out on stage was what, you know, what we made ourselves. So it was great. There was a lot of, you know, bass drum work. There was a lot of tom-tom work. There was a lot of fills, a lot of cymbals. But it gave an overall sound. And when I brought that sound back to Liverpool, And I started playing and doing exactly what I'd done in Germany, because the same thing still applied. Bill Harry came up and he nicknamed it the Atom Beat, and that stuck ever since.
You know, I heard a quote where somebody was like, Pete Best invented disco.
Well, I may have had something to do with it, yeah.
Because if you throw a little hi-hat ring right between those beats, that's like every disco beat, right? And a snare on every other one, yeah.
When you think about it, it's not far off it, yeah. So, a couple of more years, if we'd have hung in there doing that, then maybe I'd have been into disco.
Absolutely. You know, I'm a huge rock fan. I mean, a huge Beatles fan, like, ever since I was a little kid. And, like I said, it's a real honor to talk to you. Let's see, Hamburg, Germany. I'm really concerned with that. And how the Beatles were a loose outfit at one point, right? Like, it's interesting because the world, you know, they were presented to the world in like 63, 64 as this tight, collarless guys. But I think it's, how did it work when, was Stuart Sutcliffe, was he an actual good, was he a good bass player? Was he as bad as they say he was?
No, he wasn't as bad. I've always defended Stu, Jesse, and I always will. He got tarred with the same brush that I did, you know, because, media turned around and said he was a bad bass player. The same thing that happened with me. You're a bad drummer because the Beatles kicked you out. You know, the people would believe in what the press said. If they'd actually played with the guys, what you've got to remember, rock and roll was simple, okay, in those days.
Right.
And, you know, Stu played what was required, which was simple bass, which was easy for the drums to lock into, and we became the engine room of the rock band. And the way he stood on stage, you know, people thought, he doesn't know what he's playing. If you look at it, it was a great rock stance he had. You know, if he did that today, or people played like that today, right, with that stance, there'd be girls swooning on stage saying, oh, look at that, he's absolutely brilliant. But that was the karma of the man. He projected himself. But to cut the long story short, he was a good bass player. He wasn't a bad bass player.
And I figure, like, the reason why he maybe had his back towards people is he's looking at you while he's playing, so he can lock in with the drummer, probably.
It could be. That's another projection. there's lots of things, you know, which happened. It could also be the fact that he was waiting to see Astrid come in, so the more he kept, you know, looking towards the side of the stage as opposed to waiting, you know, looking into the front, he'd see her as soon as she walked into the audience.
Which brings me an interesting point. Now in this day and age, I'm sure you're familiar with the term of a hipster, right? They're people that kind of untouchable socially. They kind of dictate taste in cities. You know, they're very cool. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I'm curious about the existentialists or the exes, which Astrid was one of them, and what that did to you guys' reputation in Hamburg. Now, when they came in to the show, like, did that all of a sudden raise your profile? Like, all of a sudden now, not just the merchant seamen and whoever is watching, but the cool kids are loving the Beatles. How did that affect your reputation there in Hamburg?
Well, it was great for us simply because of the fact there was another part of the audience which we'd sort of attracted. As you turn around and say, it wasn't the normal run-of-the-mill type of people. But what actually captivated us as well was that the way that they were dressing and the style they were dressing in and the way that they handled themselves. And that was something which, okay, you know, we looked at it and it was like, yeah, we'd like to be friends with them. You know, look at the impression they're making on other people. And, of course, when we did and they became friends with us and we became friends with them, Astrid, Klaus, Jürgen, you know, all the counterparts, we suddenly realized, you know, in a way, they wanted to be us and we wanted to be them. So there was the transitional period set out for us.
Oh, interesting. Now, Stuart Sutcliffe actually ended up dating and marrying, I think, Astrid Kircher, and he quit. Mm-hmm. And he quit the Beatles. Now, at that point, Paul McCartney was like, I don't know why exactly he did the bass, but I think it was a stroke of genius. I believe personally that if McCartney had never taken over the bass, the Beatles never would have done what they did because he tied everything together so well. I want to ask you, what was it like when McCartney took over bass? How did the sound change for you?
Quite a deal of difference.
Oh, really?
Of course, there was an improvement in the style of bass which was being played, you know, because he was a better musician. So instead of just playing very simple bass, he used to add a little bit more, put a few more notes in, which was great, but it didn't detract from the sound. The sound was still there.
Okay.
The energy was still there. It's just that there was a better quality of bass being there as well.
Okay, interesting. It's good to hear it from your mouth. question I had for you. Now, you guys met Brian Epstein at one point after you came back from Germany. You were just killing the cavern. You were just ruling it. There was huge lines. You were doing lunchtime shows. And he needed something to do. He was a rich guy who owned a record store. Somebody came in asking for My Bonnie by Tony Sheridan. And what was your first meeting with Brian Epstein like? And what was your first impression of that guy?
Well, we'd known Brian Epstein, well, not to speak to. We'd seen him because with him being the manager of NEMS, you know, when we were in town and in between, you know, sets at the Cavern or, you know, if we were playing other venues, you know, which are in town, we used to go into NEMS and we used to pester the girls to, you know, get free airplay on all the new records which were being released so that we could listen to them and, you know, try and get a run on a record which no one, you know, was doing, be the first to actually perform it. So we'd seen him because he used to come down and look at us and sort of, you know, tut-tut because all the girls were going, you know, hysterical and screaming and shouting because the Beatles were in the store. And we were a little bit amazed when we got the message that he wanted to see us. And, of course, when we actually went into his office, he was the typical businessman, right? We were invited into the office. You know, he was there, he was, pinstripe suit, white shirt, clean cut, you know, nails manicured, you know, the picture of perfection.
Sure.
Very quietly spoken. And, I mean, the deal he put to us was very much a case. I've never done anything like this before. I'd like to give it a go. If it works, we continue. And that was it. That was the simple way he presented it to us. He said, go away and think about it, talk it over with your parents, you know, and if you like the idea, come back and, you know, we put a contract together. And, of course, we went away, we talked it over with our parents, we talked it over amongst ourselves, you know, because what we wanted to do was important as a band. And the consensus of opinion was, yeah, we're going to give him a go. He seems genuine. You know, to us, he was the utopia. He was the, you know, the perfect manager. Yeah, he had a record store. You know, drove around in a great big white car. The only thing he didn't smoke was a big cigar, right? And but he had the money, and we turned around and said, it's a winning combination. We've got to give it a go. You know, if we don't, we'll never know, you know, whether we would have been a success or not. And that's the reason why we signed up with him.
So real quick, two points here. Now, without Hamburg, Germany, would there be no Beatles? And without Brian Epstein, would there be no Beatles as we know of them today?
Two simple questions. It would never have happened, okay? If we hadn't gone to Hamburg, the Beatles would never have become the band which they did. So, the school in which we got in Hamburg, those long hours, turned us into this prolific rock and roll band, which came back, conquered Liverpool, conquered England, and then went on to conquer the world. So, yes, Hamburg was indirectly responsible for the Beatles performing. Brian Epstein becoming manager, I don't think anyone else could have done it. Other people tried. A lot of people helped us along the way, my mother included. She assisted, and even when Brian Epstein was on the point of signing us, he came down and saw my mother Mona and turned around and said, Mo, I'm taking the Beatles over. She said, yes, I know. He said, do you have any reservations about that? She said, no. All I'm saying is, you know, you've got an uncut diamond. You know, make sure that under your guidance you polish that diamond because they're going to make you a very rich man.
Wow.
So go with my blessings, and my goodness me, how right she was.
Well, you know, you were, including Ringo Starr, I mean, you were the drummer that played the most with the Beatles live ever, I mean, much more than Ringo. I was talking about that before you got on here, but I thought that was a really cool tidbit, you know. As far as hours on stage go, you know?
Ooh, hours on stage? My goodness me. It goes into thousands and thousands and thousands.
Yeah.
Thousands of hours. Yeah, I think I did more than 1,000 shows with them, so when you clock that up with the hours we played in Hamburg, 7 hours a night, you know, hours we did back home in England, where we'd play, you know, a dinner time session, an evening session, and an all-night session. We could be playing 3 or 4 hours a day. You know, so you clock all those up. There's an awful lot of hours gone down there.
You know, I've talked about the gigs that I would want to see in the history of the world. In the history of the world, I've told people this before I ever thought I would speak to you about it, would be to sit in Hamburg at that bar. I'd get some fish and chips and a pint of beer, and I would sit there 10 feet from the stage and watch the Beatles. Like, of all time, that would be my gig. Oh, my God, I can't believe you were there. Like, it's surreal to talk to you, like I just said, you know?
Well, I mean, out of all the places you picked, you most probably picked one of the best places you could have watched us, because, you know, we were at, I think, our most savage in Hamburg. You know, the antics we were getting up to, we had to tame it down a little bit when we came to Liverpool, simply because of the fact that we were only on stage for an hour. In Hamburg, we were on stage 6-7 hours a night. We were drinking, we were smoking on stage, we were doing everything else the rock bands did on stage, and even above that.
That was the time
to actually see us, because, you know, the music was great. What we were doing on stage was totally over the wall. Yeah.
Now, I heard that there was some uppers involved. Like, you guys would possibly do a little speed or something like that to keep yourselves up and keep going. Is that true? Is that a myth? Or do you have no comment about that?
No, I mean, to be quite honest, I mean, yeah, I mean, they pop pills. You know, it wasn't speed or anything like that. I mean, God, pills were in their infancy over there. I've always turned around and said I never got into them, just because I used to fire on schnapps and whiskey. That used to be my poison there. You know, keep me going on schnapps, keep me, you know, keep the whiskey coming, and I'll sit there and play all night for you. Well, yeah, they did. You know, it was prevalent, it was easy to get hold of, and we used it. I'm not turning around and saying that they did it every night, but yeah, you know, come the weekend or something like that, they might pop a couple of pills and, you know, rock the place down.
You know, I think a lot of people are listening to this. I want to make it clear that you were a very big part of the stage show when you played with the Beatles. I mean, I've seen pictures where they put McCartney on drums, and they put you out front to do your numbers, because, you know, you were kind of like the dreamboat of the group. And my buddy on Facebook is like, basically, Pete Best was let go because he could get the chicks. What do you have to say about that?
Well, it's nice of him to think about that. Yeah, a lot of people turn around and say that, you know, one of the reasons could have been jealousy, you know, the fact that I was becoming too popular. But as I always turn around and say, yes, you know, at that stage, there was nothing to fear, because when you look at it, there were four good-looking guys in a band, initially five when Stu was there as well.
Sure.
You know, and each one, you know, each particular night, someone would get more screams than someone else. Okay, that was great. It didn't matter to me anyway. Who the hell, the girls were screaming at? As long as they were screaming at the band, that's all I was concerned about. You know, if they were screaming for me, great. Screaming for John, great. Paul, George, smashing. You know,
they were there, and
they were screaming. They were adding to the atmosphere, and that's what we were firing off.
Yeah, awesome. You know, I just bought this Decca demos last night in Cabin. What the hell is it? I can't speak right now. Anyway, the Decca demos rehearsal stuff and amazing stuff. I really love the style, and I was kind of struck by how much you guys were kind of sounding like, to me, like Roy Orbison and Elvis Presley. The way Paul would sing with this little flutter at his voice at the end of each line was very like 50s rock and roll, and they kind of shed that by the time their first record proper came out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think that was part of the rock image when you think about it. You know, the names you mentioned, Presley, Orbison, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis, Vincent Cochran, Richard Devlin Brothers, that's what we cut our teeth on. You know, that's what we were listening to. They were the people, they were our idols. You know, they were the people that we were mimicking. So, yes, there would be influences. Paul would have copied them, you know, unbeknownst to himself, it would have come into the way he was singing, you know, the way he carried a number off. But I think that happened with all of them. You know, George was a very big Carl Perkins fan. Carl Perkins and George's guitar playing at the early age, his vocals. You know, John was a big Vincent fan, and you could tell by the way he stands, the way he, you know, he delivers his vocals, you know, very Vincent-like, you know.
Yeah, now, so you did the Decca audition. Back then, drummers got a really hard time. I mean, they would bring in studio drummers all the time. There was some question about your drumming or whatever. And basically, you were switched out for Ringo. Man, like, it happens all the time. I mean, the story to me isn't that you were switched out for Ringo, but it was the fact that you basically started the biggest pop culture phenomenon, aside from certain religions, that's ever existed. And that's amazing to me. What are your thoughts about starting something that is just appreciated worldwide and bigger than anything that ever was? Are you proud of this? What specifically, how do you feel?
Yeah, you've got to be proud. I mean, you know, regardless of, they stayed together for what, 8 years, 8 or 9 years. I knew them for three, played with them for two. You know, those 2 years that I played with them are most probably the most formative years of the band.
For sure.
You know, from an early stage. You know, what they transposed to afterwards, you know, is just beyond anyone's belief. But yes, pride's got to be there. You know, you contributed something. you know, and people make their own estimation about that, how much the contribution was. You know, the fact that you, contributed something to the biggest band in the history of music, you've got to carry that with pride, and you've got to be proud about what you input in.
Absolutely. Now, once that all went down, you started a band called the Pete Best Band. Is that right?
That's right. Basically, the Pete Best Four, and then went on to become the Pete Best Band, yeah.
And you guys were rocking steady. You even came to America a couple times until what, 67, 68?
67, 68, and by that time I was married, and I, you know, had to make the decision to, you know, I was married and had a, you know, one or two beautiful daughters, and I had to make the decision whether I was going to persevere in music, which was very, you know, haphazard at that particular moment in time. And then it was, you know, I had to start looking towards, you know, supporting them for the future, making sure that they had a decent wage, a steady income, you know, and then I could provide for them, basically.
Right. How long did it take you before that initial, or I mean, are you still feeling it today? Like that initial shock and anger or whatever of being replaced like you were? I mean, they were just young guys. I figure they were probably really immature the way they did it, you know, and having never really addressed you. How long did it take before you were kind of over it and fine with the situation? Did it take quite a few years?
It took a couple of years, simply because of the fact that, you know, even though you wanted to put it behind you, I think what was going on at that time, you know, because they were moving so fast, and they were never off the, you know, off the television, off the media, off the, you know, off the papers, you know, right. Off the records. And it was very much a case of, yes, you know, even though you'd put it to the back of your mind, you'd be constantly reminded about the fact that, okay, you should have been part of it. Even people in the street would come up to you and turn around and say, my God, Pete, you know, you should have been part of this. You take that and you keep suppressing it, and then all of a sudden there's one day, and you can't count it on your fingers, and you don't know the hour, but you wake up one morning and you turn around and say, hang on a minute, you know, why do I always keep reflecting on what's happened? You know, it could have been, it should have been. It's very much about today and tomorrow. And I think once you get into that state of mind and you've got that and you come from a strong family which supports you, once you overcome and you've reached that point, then it pales into total insignificance. And since then, you know, there's been lots of things in life which have compensated, you know, for that particular dismissal. You know, I've got my health and happiness. You know, married to a lovely Liverpool girl for 50 years, two daughters, four grandchildren, a great band, the Pete Best Band, which is still touring the world even today and getting great acclaim.
Heck yeah, you were in Chile and, a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, it was great. I went out there, you know, the crowd were absolutely fantastic, you know, and, you know, hopefully we're going back again towards the end of this year.
Now, are you playing any of those old numbers like, let's see, did you play I Want to Be Your Man, or did you sing that rather with the Beatles? Is that one of your numbers?
I've played it with them. I never sang it. No, I used to sing. My three favorites were Peppermint Twist, Matchbox, and the Elvis Presley number, Wild in the Country. They were my three.
Oh, well, real quick, I wanted to ask you. Well, this is really intriguing to me. What was any? And we'll get right to the Pete Best Band, the Heyman's Green, which I really like, and I'm going to play later in the show, like three cuts off it. What was the creative process like, man? Like when you sat down, we're going back just a little bit, but when you sat down to write stuff like "Love Me Do," was it a situation where John and Paul came in and they kind of had something, and you know, maybe you and George and Stu just kind of fit in where you could, or was it collaborative? How did the creative process making new songs work? I mean, I understand the cover songs, you probably modeled them after the originals, but
mm-hmm. Yeah, you know. Yeah, that's true. That's because you know their own original material or stuff that we, you know, transposing, you know, like old stuff, you know, and giving it an uplift. But talking about the original stuff, someone will come in with the lyrics, e.g., you know, take Paul, for example, he'd have a chord structure, or John would have a chord structure behind it, you know, this is how I think it should go, he'd run it through, George and I had listened to it, George would start turning around and saying, okay, I'll do some licks, you know, see if these fit in, I'd work out the tempo, you know, so it was all collaborative, you could put it that way, everyone put their ideas into the melting pot. And if it worked, the best ideas were taken out. It was tried on stage. If it worked, we kept it. If it didn't work, we kept changing it around. And that's, of course, what we did with Love Me Do and P.S. I Love You, which went on to become the first releases for Parlophone.
Yeah, no, I love those songs. Now, bringing it up to more recent. Now you released Heyman's Green, which is that is not in Liverpool. Is that right outside Liverpool? I know it's an area where the Casbah is. Is that in Liverpool or outside?
Heyman's Green is actually the road, and we're in number 8 Heyman's Green. And everyone always alludes to the Casbah or the house in Heyman's Green as Heyman's Green. So, you know, Heyman's Green is the road where the Casbah is actually in. It's where the house actually stands, which is number 8.
Okay.
Hence, we wanted to call it Heyman's Green because so much took place there.
I like how for the cover of that, you took the little snippet that they kind of like took your face off the anthology. And by the way, like, I love those songs on the anthology. It's from the Decca demos, but they're so sweet, man. Really, really good.
Well, I think that's one thing which is great. I mean, you know, when you think about them, they're nearly 50, 60 years old now. But they still sound good. You know, they've still stood up to the test of time, which, you know, goes for, you know, what was happening and the fact that, you know, their music still transposed so many generations even today.
Now, speaking of Heyman's Green, how long did that how long did that take you to record? And that was released in 2008, I think. And where was it recorded?
Well, we actually recorded it in the recording studio at the Casbah.
Oh, really?
We got a recording studio alongside the offices. And it was recorded here. It took us about 12 months from start to finish because we were touring at that time. We were working, people were doing different things, so they'd come in and, you know, work on it when they could. So from start to finish, I'd say about 12 months. But it was something we wanted to make sure everyone was happy with it. You know, the mix downs had to be perfect, the quality, the ideas that we wanted to, you know, transpose into it. We wanted people to let us know that, yes, you know, we can write songs equally as good as anyone else.
Yeah, I would say they're really great. We're going to give everybody listening a taste of that after I hang up with you. So let's see here. Heyman's Green. Now, I know that you have a bunch of things you want to promote right now, basically social media stuff like that. Tell me about your touring that's happening right now, if you're coming to the States, or where you're going, your website and your Twitter account.
Okay. Touring. First country we're going through this particular year is Japan. We'll be there in March, April of this particular year.
Okay.
There's negotiations afoot for possibly coming back to the States towards the back end of the year, but that all depends on availability.
Come to Seattle, Come to Seattle.
We'll try. So it's a case of, you know, ooh, what else have we got on it? Germany, Spain, Italy. As I turn around and say, as these dates are confirmed, they're actually put onto my website, petebest.com, which also promotes the Casbah as well, you know, so, you know, people can find out exactly what's happening with the band, what's happening with the Casbah. So that's why I'm, you know, very interested in making sure that people, you know, get the chance to log onto it, petebest.com, and find out what's happening.
You know, I'm not sure about this. I think the Casbah just opened in the past couple years again. And when I heard that, I was like, that's the Beatles' place to go, because the Cavern isn't even the same Cavern. The Casbah seems to be it.
As I said before, Jesse, at the present moment, we are the only original, you know, the rock and roll club and rock and roll cellar in Liverpool, which stands in its total originality. And I think the beauty of it was recognized by, you know, Liverpool Heritage, or English Heritage, it should say, around and say, when they deemed it to be a Grade II listed building and, you know, gave it a blue plaque, which means that it's down as, you know, an important historical monument in the, you know, the annals of history. So that was great. It was a great compliment for ourselves and, of course, an even bigger compliment for my mother, Mona.
How big is the actual cast? Like, there's a couple rooms, but can you say how big are they? How many people do they fit?
Well, at a maximum, they holds about 300 people. But there's, let me just off the top of my head, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 rooms, including the coffee bar. So a lot of people have got misconceptions. Some people have come and turned around and said, ooh, it's a lot bigger than what we thought. And you also get other people who turn around and go, ooh, I always thought it would have been a lot bigger than that. But the contributing factor is, you know, they always turn around and say, the atmosphere that's in the Casbah, you know, if we could bottle that and sell it, you know, my family would be millionaires tomorrow. But it's one of those things, you know, people have got to come. They all come away with the same thing. You know, it's one of these places, the Casbah. You've got to see it. You've got to feel it. You've got to feel the atmosphere and, you know, make your own decisions about it. But it's one of those places.
I will tell you, man, I am going to hit Liverpool. I'm going to go to Liverpool and one day, and I will. That's my first destination. I can't wait. It sounds like an amazing place.
Well, you better tell us when you're coming so that we can meet you.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, man. Yeah, I got your number, man. So, hey, one last thing, man. You want to tell about your Twitter account. What's your Twitter?
Oh, yeah. Talking about Facebook as well, Jesse.
Yeah, Facebook.
As I turn around and say, pretty much into Facebook at the moment, facebook.com, Pete Best Official, and the Twitter account, because, you know, at the present moment, I've started this off, twitter.com, Beatles Pete Best. And it's great because, you know, I can keep people updated with what I'm happening. They can let me know. We can have a chat. And, you know, it's this social media thing. Modern technology gone mad. But the more the merrier. I want people to visit all the sites, get involved, and let's just make friends, you know. Hopefully, you know, someday I'll be able to meet all of these people. But if we can't, then let's talk to one another over the media.
Right, so we got PeteBest.com on the internet. We got Pete Best Official on Facebook. And one more time the Twitter?
The Twitter is twitter.com BeatlesPeteBest.
BeatlesPeteBest. Yeah, I would urge anybody listening to this right now to go check those out, sign up. Pete's a great man, a historical guy. And so one last thing, man, before I let you go, you gave me a half hour. I said I'm going to try to make you go for 45 minutes. You know what, man? We've been talking for 46 minutes.
Oh, go on. You're winning. You're winning. Go on.
So what did you think of Paul McCartney joining with Nirvana, with Sirvana at the 12-12-12? Did you catch that at all?
I didn't. I'm certain that I'm going to hear an awful lot more about it. But it's one of those things. You know, Paul is doing a lot of appearances all over the world at the present moment with, you know, some of his rock idols and things which he's wanted to do, and I'm certain that this was one of them.
Right on. I really like the song, and you know, Pete, if you go on YouTube, you can actually look up McCartney and Nirvana and check it out. It's a pretty, really rock-and-heavy song.
Well, I'll check that out for myself. Yeah.
Okay, man. Well, listen, it has been a real pleasure. I've been anticipating this for 2 months, man. Everybody on Facebook is so excited. I'm having people come out of the woodwork, like, you know, my little cousin. He's just like, I love Pete Best, and he wants an autograph, and maybe one day we can arrange that.
That'd be my pleasure.
But you know what? It's been a hell of a time talking to you. Thank you so much. And I'm going to go on. I'm going to play some Heyman's Green. I'm going to play some Everly Brothers, some Chuck Berry, some Lonnie Donegan, and some more Beatles cuts in the next hour and a half. And it's going to be great. And that's it, man. Thank you so much. And hopefully we'll talk soon, Pete.
I hope so, Jesse. And thanks for your time. Thanks for your trouble. And
no trouble, you know, man. No trouble.
And, you know, hopefully we can do it again sometime.
As soon as you got something to promote, or when I'm in Liverpool, dude, all right?
Well, okay, let's hope that you're in Liverpool a lot quicker than what I've got to promote.
Okay.
Just, I'm wishing you're over here.
Thanks, man. Hey, have a great one. See you, Pete.
And you as well. Okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.